Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, teaching hope through prayer, action, and suffering. Pope Benedict opens a conference on that theme here in Rome. We take a peek at a newly restored ancient Roman mausoleum beneath St. Peter's Basilica, and from an Iraqi doctor to a disabled probation officer, a charity in Britain honors Catholic women for distinguished service to the community and the church. Jesus has risen, teaching hope through prayer, action, and suffering. That's the theme of an annual ecclesial convention of the Rome Diocese inaugurated by Pope Benedict late on Monday. The Holy Father presided a special liturgy of the word in Rome's Basilica of St. John Lateran for the occasion. Chris Altieri has more on that.
The theme of the annual gathering of priests, bishops, men and women religious, and lay faithful belonging to the parishes and church movements in Rome is this year, Jesus Christ is Risen, educating for hope in prayer, in action, and in suffering. On Monday evening, Pope Benedict told the participants in Rome's annual ecclesial convention the task of educating in and for true hope is one that involves families, individuals, and society at large. The Holy Father said, Christ, who died and is risen from the dead, is the unfailing foundation of our faith and our hope. Pope Benedict spoke to the participants after the scripture reading, which was taken from the letter of St. Paul to the Romans, and the reading of a brief section of the Holy Father's recent encyclical, Spe Salvi, in which the Holy Father wrote, God is the foundation of hope, not any God, but the God who has a human face and who has loved us to the end, each one of us and humanity in its entirety. I'm Chris Altieri.
Well, earlier Monday, Pope Benedict received in audience the professors, students, and administrators of the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy, which trains the Holy See's diplomats. Chris Altieri again.
Founded in 1701 as the Pontifical Academy of Ecclesiastical Nobles, the mission of the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy is to train priests to serve in the diplomatic corps and the Secretariat of State of the Holy See. Located in the center of Rome, just off the square dominated by the Pantheon, the Academy accepts priests from all parts of the world who have been released by their bishops to study ecclesiastical and international diplomacy in preparation for service in the diplomatic posts and offices of the Holy See.
Nel vostro quotidiano lavoro verite a contatto con realtà ecclesiali da comprendere e sostenere.
Pope Benedict spoke of service in the Holy See's diplomatic corps as a great adventure, telling the students they would come into contact with a wide range of ecclesial realities that they would have to understand and support. They would live in countries far from their homelands, countries they would come to know and love. Pope Benedict said the students would have to learn to conduct bilateral and multilateral diplomacy and be ever ready to offer not only their professional expertise as diplomats, but first and foremost, in all places, the example of priestly witness.
Ma anche e soprattutto la vostra testimonianza sacerdotale.
Though the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy was founded only in the 18th century, the diplomatic service of the Holy See can be said to have its beginnings with Pope Sylvester I, who sent legates to represent him during the discussions of the First Council of Nicaea. Many prominent churchmen have been alumni of the Academy, including Popes Benedict XV and Paul VI.
And thanks there to Chris Altieri for those reports. Year round, tens of thousands of pilgrims and tourists file through the doors of St. Peter's Basilica and the Vatican Museums for a glimpse of centuries of artistic masterworks. But how many of them know that just around to the left side of the basilica, there's a set of stairs that take you down to the very bowels of the earth, to the tomb of St. Peter himself? More and more people have discovered the Vatican scavi, or excavations, of an ancient Roman necropolis, an early Christian burial site beneath St. Peter's Basilica. It can only be seen by small groups of people by appointment. Though excavations have gone on under the basilica for decades, archaeologists probably aren't even close to revealing all the treasures lying beneath it. The latest work among the ancient Roman tombs is actually a labor of love to restore the 2nd century mausoleum of the Valeri to its former splendor. The mausoleum is one of the most beautifully decorated tombs beneath the floor of St. Peter's Basilica, but humidity and earlier restorations had left it in a precarious condition. A team of archaeologists, art historians, and restorers worked 10 long months on the restoration project funded by the Foundation for Music and Sacred Art, a nonprofit organization active in the restoration of precious works of church art and masterpieces. Lydia O'Kane spoke with the general director of the Vatican office responsible for St. Peter's Basilica, St. Peter's Fabric. Dr. Maria Cristina Carlo Stella told her a combination of modern technology and simply a passion for artistic beauty came together to make the work a success.
It was extremely important. We had, in this particular mausoleum, which is really a very unique example, perhaps in Roman funerary art, we had quite a series of ermae. These ermae that are like caryatids on the wall surface, many of them, quite a number of them, were falling apart. And why? Because of the humidity, because of materials that was applied in the 1950s, which was not durable, which was not suitable for that kind of restoration. So just the hermit itself really needed very badly restoration. The other thing is that the humidity level, we have placed a monitoring system to keep the humidity level balanced. The problem with that is sometimes in the past there were imbalances in the humidity level, and this created the growth of these microorganisms, these various types of microorganisms, fungi that actually were attached to the wall surface, and very slowly they just disintegrated it. So there were areas of the mausoleum where you really needed a lot of work. There were two major difficulties. One is to actually prepare that environment of the mausoleum, make it adaptable for the restoration. And that was quite difficult because, of course, it's not very spacious. So mechanically speaking, there were difficulties there. Technically speaking, meaning the methods of restoration, that was extremely difficult in certain areas where where cement had been applied on the wall surface way back in the 1950s. What happens with cement is that it hardens, and when it hardens into the wall surface, you begin the cracking between the surfaces. And so to get that out between the cracks was extremely difficult. And this is why in this occasion, a laser technique was applied, and the results were absolutely excellent.
So there was a lot of modern technology used for this purpose?
For this particular restoration, yes. There were very specific drills that are usually used for dentistry. And this kind of drill was applied for the restoration. And the second thing is a very specific type of laser that was applied. So thanks to these two technical mechanical instruments, the restoration was able to reveal these results.
How much of a labor of love was this particular restoration, and how happy are you with the result of it?
It was a great labor of love. I think that basically if you go through even the first comments of the very first archaeologists who started excavating this Vatican necropolis, they all commented, and I'm talking about Ferrua, I'm talking about Kirschbaum, I'm talking about Guarducci, they all commented how special this mausoleum was, not only for the stucco surfaces, but also for those fantastic, beautiful marble heads that were found that most probably were made of Greek marble, which was an extraordinary find. So all of them commented that this was really the key place, besides the tomb of St. Peter, but this mausoleum of the Valeri, as well as the mausoleum of the Iuli, are the two key places of the entire Vatican necropolis. So we had waited for funds for many, many years to do this. When I came 5 years ago, I've been working in the Vatican for 20 years, but I started here as head of staff 5 years ago. That was the first thing that really was in my heart, to find enough money to actually complete a very good restoration that could also guarantee a sustainable development of the entire necropolis, but also of this particular environment. I really want the visitors who walk in the Vatican necropolis to absorb that beauty and to really understand the intrinsic value, the spiritual value. It is a very spiritual place. Art is a very spiritual thing. It's supposed to elevate your consciousness to something beyond. And so the Vatican necropolis is quite unique in that as well, because besides these really extraordinary, beautiful environments of these funerary chambers, all these funerary chambers lead to a very sacred place, the tomb of Peter.
Dr. Maria Cristina Carlo Stella is the General Director of the Vatican Office responsible for St. Peter's Basilica, St. Peter's Fabric. Could an Iraqi doctor, a disabled probation officer, a nun working with victims of sex trafficking, and a prison worker have in common? Doesn't sound like there could be much. But if you look a little deeper, you'll find that all of these women are Catholic, and they're all recipients of the Catholic Women of the Year Award. For more than 40 years, an organization in Britain has been singling out women like these for their distinguished service to the community and to the church. Well, in coming weeks, we'll be talking with some of the winners of this year's award, which is traditionally handed out in October every year. But today, journalist and member of the awards panel, Joanna Bogle, tells us about how the award came about some 40 years ago and who are some of the extraordinary women who've made such a mark on human hearts.
It was 1968, which was in many ways a challenging year for the church. There was a lot of dissent to Catholic teaching, a lot of disloyalty within the church in that summer of 1968. And a group of Catholic women based in London thought that it would be a good idea to show how Catholic women love and support the church. And they had the idea of having an award for Catholic women who serve the church in perhaps unobtrusive ways at the ordinary level of parishes and community work, and also as Catholics in public life, as magistrates, borough councillors, in politics, and so on. And they arranged that they would do this in the form of a luncheon. And they would also use the money that raised by the luncheon to support a different charity every year. And the first luncheon was actually held at London Zoo, because they have a really nice restaurant there which could be hired. And the press thought that was just so funny. I mean, Catholic women meeting at London Zoo. So in a funny way, the whole thing got off to a terrific start.
Who are some of the extraordinary women that you've named in the past? You, talking with me earlier, you called them the unsung heroines.
When the luncheon began, the idea was to get ordinary Catholics and non-Catholics to nominate a Catholic woman who was really doing some worthwhile work, not necessarily within the church, but within the local or even national community. And often these include people who are quite well known, members of parliament, for example, or the founders of some major charitable initiative. But we're also particularly interested in women who are really only known at a local level and sometimes are just doing some terrific work, for example, fostering children from troubled backgrounds or caring for elderly people in some local initiative which ensures that they have a nice place to meet and some social life when they'd otherwise be lonely. And such women are often known and loved by their immediate neighbours, but not well known in the wider sphere. And sometimes it isn't known that they're a Catholic. They are just known as a terrifically kind and good person. They may vaguely be known to have religious beliefs, but the depth of their faith is not known because they don't brag about it. And that was the kind of person we really, really wanted to celebrate. And in nominations initially went out through Catholic newspapers, just a letter in the press saying, send in your nominations, and were spread through community organizations and Catholic organizations. But every year, it sort of has grown, because there's a stage now, after 40 years, where the Catholic community and many people sort of recognize that it's about time to send in their nominations. So in the spring, they sort of expect this letter to appear and announcements to be made in the parish newsletter and so on. And so they're able to send in their nominations.
How many nominations do you get every year?
Well, it really, really varies, but it's generally in the range of about 40 to 80 nominations. It varies every year. Out of these, the panel has to select four Catholic Women of the Year. It's about 40 to 50 to 80 or 90 nominations. They all have to be listed and all the letters have to be kept and, where necessary, retyped or photocopied so that it's possible for every member of the panel to read every letter and back up information and so on. So it's quite a big paperwork job. And the number of nominations, well, it fluctuates every year. And of course, it quite often happens that we get several nominations for the same person, although that doesn't necessarily influence the panel. We don't want to be lobbied. That's not the idea at all.
How many people are on your panel, and what sort of walks of life do they come from?
The panel for the Catholic Women of the Year is drawn from major Catholic organizations. All the major Catholic women's organizations are represented. There's a representative from each one. So we're talking about the Catholic Women's League, the Union of Catholic Mothers, the Association of Catholic Women, the big organizations. Then there are the other Catholic lay movements that are not specifically for women but are very active. The Catholic Writers Guild, of which I'm a member, National Association of Catholic Families, that sort of thing. And each of those send a representative. So it's any Catholic organization that is either for women or has a very large number of women within it. But it's lay organizations. Sort of official bureaucracy of the church, if I may so express it, is not represented. It's all the genuine, voluntary, you know, unpaid, real organizations within the church, the lay movements, really.
Now, does your award winner have to be British?
The award is for Catholic women in England and Wales. So, yes, it's strictly within that. But we invite other countries to pick up the idea if they think it's a good one.
Well, it does sound like a good one, but you have to tell us a little bit more about what the award actually entails. I know that you say that the winners don't receive any prize money per se, but you do give money to charities. Is that given on their behalf? How does the award actually work?
Well, the award works by inviting the four nominated, the four women who have been chosen from all the letters that are sent in by the panel of judges, which is representing all the different organizations. The four ladies finally chosen, voted for by members of the panel, come to the Catholic Women of the Year luncheon, which is a very big event. We have a guest speaker. We invite somebody distinguished to sort of open the luncheon. We always have a message of greeting from the Holy Father. We write to him and he writes back a letter which we read aloud, and from the nuncio, who often attends as well, and from the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster usually attends, and so on. It's a big do. And we have a guest speaker. And every year, the luncheon also raises money for a charity. This is independent of any of the Catholic Women of the Year who are nominated. They are simply there to receive their honour and award. Then, as each Catholic Woman of the Year is announced, her sort of citation is read aloud. In fact, we used to get a rather distinguished actress to do this. And in recent years, we've just started getting younger people to do it. It's always rather grand, and she comes in, and everybody stands and applauds and takes her place at the top table. And the luncheon begins with this sort of honouring of the Catholic Women of the Year. But we're rather proud of the fact it's a tradition that they don't actually get anything. They get the love and support and applause of their fellow Catholic women. But there's no money, there's not a medal. We do give them a sort of commemorative certificate. And the work that they're doing will always receive a huge boost from this award, obviously. And many of these Catholic women who have been involved in some project have found that it's just absolutely got huge after, you know, getting this massive publicity and support. But they don't get anything out of it. And that's part of what we're trying to say, really. We, you know, we all serve this for the love of God, for the love of the church. And you're not going to get anything out of this. But, you know, because we think what you're doing is beautiful, we want to give you a huge collective hug and round of applause. And that's all you're getting, really.
Well, it sounds quite inspiring. Well, how is the award regarded, let's say, outside the Catholic community in the UK?
Well, actually, it's quite funny because the expression being a Catholic Woman of the Year sounds really very grand. And even though you don't get an award, all you get is a free lunch. You know, there's this saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, there is if you're a Catholic Woman of the Year. So you turn up with family and parish priest usually and so on. It's a lovely occasion. But that really is all. However, in our experience, usually the local newspaper pick up the story and sometimes the national press too. And so there is this tremendous accolade, you're a Catholic Woman of the Year. And people are rather impressed by this, I think. There is, I suspect, a general perception in Britain about the Catholic Church. People aren't quite aware of how very active Catholics are in a whole range of activities. Because, you know, you don't parade your faith. You don't say, well, I'm running this old people's club because I'm a practicing Roman Catholic. I mean, you know, you just do it for love of God and neighbour. So it's really been quite effective in a way in showing how faith translates into real, cheerful, neighbourly service. And I think that's really perhaps helped other people who are not Catholics to understand the way a Christian works, you know, how you translate your faith into love of others. And I think to that extent it's been quite fun. But I think a lot of the women are slightly embarrassed. I mean, you know, you always hear the comment, oh, I'm not special, I'm just doing, you know, what anyone would do. They're usually very, very embarrassed to be a Catholic Woman of the Year. It's not something they want, and they usually sort of laugh a little bit and pull a face about it, you know.
Do you hope that by awarding these women with this nominal prize, do you hope to hold them up as an example to other women and even perhaps to men?
Yes, I think there is a general feeling that it's very good that we all need to be inspired and encouraged. So, yes, I would say women who are Catholic Women of the Year, they're usually embarrassed about it, but they are wonderful role models for other people. We try to get a range of women, different ages and different backgrounds, and above all, different types of service that they've given. Obviously, it tends to be older women because it's only towards the end of people's lives and achievements that they're likely to be nominated. But we often do get younger ones who've done something very enterprising. One year, just recently, we had a young woman who was running a natural family planning fertility care service. She's a young nurse who'd got this going. And her nomination enabled her work to become better known. And it's just absolutely great having a young woman. Another one was a girl at university. And another one was one a young woman who had helped refugees in Bosnia. So they often are younger, but they're mostly older women. And it's an opportunity for, I think, the whole Catholic community to see what ordinary people can do as lay people in the course of an ordinary busy life with, you know, other family and job responsibilities. It sounds clumsy if you put it like role model and inspiration, but these are very important things. And yes, I think it lifts morale too. It reminds us all we belong to a beautiful church with glorious teachings.
I probably should have asked you this earlier, but why an award for women?
Well, this is something we've often discussed, and it may be that as the years go by, it will change. You have to think back to the 1960s. There was a lot of debate at the time about the relationship between women and the church. And there was a feeling at the time that women were undervalued in the Catholic Church. I'm not sure that's true, really. I mean, it's a bit difficult to look at a church with Catherine of Siena and Teresa of Avila and so on and say that, you know, women aren't important in the church. I think that's silly. And Catholic women know that the church honors us. There are more churches named after women than men and so on. But there was, in the 60s and 70s, a bit of a debate going on about that. So there was this desire to affirm to the wider world and within the church the authentic role and huge achievements of Catholic women. Maybe that debate has moved on. Pope John Paul made a big difference with his encyclical Mulieris Dignitatem, which really emphasized the role of women. And the present Holy Father has touched on this very considerably in his writings. It may be that there'll be a time when we don't feel that we need to specify Catholic women. In fact, there is a problem for young Catholic men in the church. Religion is often seen as a girly thing, and perhaps we need to start thinking about ways of helping young men to see the terrific role they've got in the church and the potential for manly service. Maybe there's a role for that. Perhaps there'll be a time when the Catholic Women of the Year luncheon looks a little bit outdated. Well, that's all right. You know, nothing like that lasts forever, so we'll move on. But I do think it's been important to celebrate and honour what Catholic women can and should be doing for God and neighbour. I think that's been a useful thing to do. And it's sort of exciting to us that we've managed to keep doing it for 40 years.
Journalist Joanna Bogle is a member of the awards panel for the Catholic Women of the Year Award. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.